The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. This morning, the court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are American Type Culture Collection Incorporated versus Marshall Coleman and others from Brazoria County and the First Appellate District, Century Marine Incorporated and others versus Charles Glenn Backlico from Orange County and the Ninth Appellate District, and the Cities of Austin and others versus Southwestern Bell Telephone from Travis County and the Third Appellate District. Court is allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument in each of these matters. The petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshals of the court. We will take a brief recess in between each argument and complete the arguments by noon. These arguments are being recorded, and you may purchase a tape of any of the arguments for a nominal fee from the clerk. Justice Rodriguez is recused in the first matter, and we are ready to hear arguments in that matter from the petitioner.
May it please the court, Mr. Slattery will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, Sam Sipe on behalf of petitioner American Type Culture Collection. This case raises an important issue regarding the defendant's burden of negating grounds for personal jurisdiction in an action brought in Texas state court.
Can you address jurisdiction first before we get to whether the substance is important enough?
Certainly, Your Honor. Would you like to focus me on a particular aspect of it?
Yes. What in the Court of Appeals opinion gives us jurisdiction? What in the circumstances of this case?
In the circumstances of this case, we believe the decision below is inconsistent with the Supreme Court's decision in the Siskind case, setting out the standards for burden of proof and a special appearance. We also believe this case is important for the jurisprudence of Texas, both with respect to the burden of proof issue and with respect to the Court of Appeals comparative jurisdiction test.
Do you believe there's a dissent in the Court of Appeals or not?
There was not a dissent from a three-judge panel. There was a dissent from the denial of en banc rehearing by Justice O'Connor.
And is that dissent sufficient to provide us with jurisdiction or not?
We believe it is, Your Honor, for the reasons I've already stated. There are two principal grounds of error that we allege in this case. The first is that the Court of Appeals misconstrued the burden of proof on defendant ATCC by requiring the defendant to negate all possible bases of jurisdiction. The second error has to do with the court's establishment of a test of comparative jurisdiction, whereby the court faulted ATCC for not presenting more detailed evidence of its contacts with other jurisdictions outside Texas. We maintain that the Court of Appeals erred in both instances. This case arises out of a mass tort suit in which plaintiffs allege that ATCC, among some 80 other defendants, shipped materials to Iraq in the 1980s that formed the basis for the Iraqis to manufacture chemical and biological weapons. As relevant here, they claim that ATCC had sufficient contacts with Texas to permit its courts to exercise general jurisdiction. I would point out at this point that everyone agrees this is not a specific jurisdiction case. There's no allegation that the cause of action arose from any act in Texas or from any of ATCC's limited contacts with Texas. ATCC is a nonprofit corporation organized under the laws of the District of Columbia which at all relevant times had its principal place of business in Rockville, Maryland. ATCC serves as a long-term repository and distribution center for living microorganisms, viruses, and cell lines, which it makes available to scientists and researchers around the world. The jurisdictional facts are not in dispute. ATCC produced evidence at the special appearance hearing demonstrating that it is not authorized to do business in Texas, has no registered agent for the service of process in Texas, it doesn't have an office or other facilities, any real property, a bank account, any telephone listing in Texas, it does not recruit employees in Texas, it has no Texas distributors for its products, and it doesn't control the research performed by Texas entities that receive biological materials from ATCC. The framework for establishing personal jurisdiction over a specially appearing non-resident defendant is well established in the decisions of this court, and in particular the Schlobaum decision, the Guardian Royal Exchange decision, CSR v. Link, all enunciate the principles. Texas long-arm statute reaches as far as the Due Process Clause of the United States Constitution permits. The critical test for personal jurisdiction, general personal jurisdiction, is the purposeful availment test set out in the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Burger King and reiterated in each of the three Texas Supreme Court decisions that I've referenced. The constitutional touchstone of this determination is whether the defendant purposely established minimum contacts in the forum state. The minimum contacts inquiry asks whether the non-resident defendant purposefully avails itself of the privilege of conducting business, thereby invoking the benefits and protections of the laws of the forum state. There is language in the cases that discusses the concept of foreseeability. And the Court of Appeals below seemed to focus on foreseeability in suggesting that ATCC, because it had numerous sales to Texas, could have foreseen the possibility of being sued in Texas on an action that did not arise here. But all the cases link the concept of foreseeability to the governing purposeful availment standard. Contacts with a forum state are foreseeable precisely because the non-resident defendant directs his activities to the forum state. Here, the Court of Appeals uncoupled the foreseeability standard from the purposeful availment test, and that's one of the essential bases of its error. In both the Supreme Court's Guardian Royal decision and lower court decisions following that, there's a clear recognition that foreseeability may not be uncoupled from purposeful availment. The only way you can read that test is in the context of purposeful availment. Similarly, the other tests that have been articulated for personal jurisdiction, whether, for example, a defendant's contacts are random, fortuitous, or attenuated, need to be read in light of the governing purposeful availment standard.
Would any amount of business ever be determinative by itself, quantitative amount?
I don't believe so. Standing by itself without evidence of some intent to direct conduct to the forum state, the laws and the prior cases of this court would suggest that is not purposeful availment. Now, I think we could hypothesize that in a case where there was a very high percentage of sales to a particular jurisdiction, a percentage that vastly exceeded the proportion of residents or whoever the purchasers were for the relevant materials, that there might be other factors, suggesting that the defendant had directed its contacts to the foreign state.
Would one of those facts be the nature of the business? For example, if you were making equipment, rendering services for a particular kind of industry, that might naturally be isolated in two or three or five or eight locations.
I don't think the case law gives us much guidance on that. However, I think it's a reasonable inference that if a particular state had a very strong association with a particular commercial activity, and the defendant's activities focused strongly on that particular activity, one might want to delve into the facts more thoroughly. And I believe in that circumstance, for example, if the plaintiff had alleged, and this goes to the burden issue, if the plaintiff had alleged that a particular defendant focused its commercial activities on a particular sector, and the forum state also emphasized that particular sector, the defendant, the allegation might be that the defendant had intended to focus its activities there. And there's an instance where, if the plaintiff had so alleged, the defendant would have a burden, I believe, under the decisions of this court to respond with evidence denying that allegation. All the cases that we've cited in our briefs and all the cases of this court, and with the exception of the Court of Appeals below and one or two decisions that it's followed, every other case that we have found indicate this burden of negation is only a burden to address and negate the jurisdictional facts as alleged by the plaintiff. It's not a burden to negate all conceivable bases of jurisdiction.
But would you tell me how you think the trial court or the Court of Appeals actually applied what they said was the burden to negate all possible grounds, and whether that application reaches that level or whether it reached the level that Siskin and the other cases say would just negate all grounds of personal jurisdiction?
I think there are several ways in which the Court of Appeals imposed this unreasonable burden on ATCC and relied on it in this case. For example, the Court of Appeals faulted ATCC for failing to offer proof demonstrating that no Texas residents requested or were provided with ATCC's applied science services or newsletters and manuals. But there was no allegation in the record from plaintiff that ATCC had done so. Similarly, the Court of Appeals repeatedly insisted that ATCC should have offered affirmative proof of its contacts with other jurisdictions to satisfy its burden. And in the matter of ATCC's limited contracts with Texas defendants, the Court of Appeals faulted ATCC for failing affirmatively to show that there was a choice of law provision indicating the contract would be adjudicated under the laws of another state. Those instances of burden, imposition of burden, seem to us to have been decisive elements in the court's reasoning. The other decisive element in the court's reasoning, and this is the bedrock fact that the Court of Appeals referred to in its rehearing decision, is the quantity and volume of sales that ATCC made to Texas. There is evidence in the record of sales to Texas over an 18-month period that represented approximately 3.5% of ATCC's worldwide sales, and there is evidence that these sales were on a continuing basis over time. However, the courts have made clear that the test is not the quantity and volume of sales. The test is the quality and nature of the sales, and that is to be determined by looking back to indications of the defendant's intent to establish contacts with the forum state. Here, there's no indication that ATCC structured its sales so as to reach out to Texas. It had no specific advertisements addressed to Texas residents. It has no sales force here. It structured the sales so they were all consummated FOB Rockville, Maryland.
But your opponent says that you allege that, but there was never any proof that actually was the way you sold it.
The briefs and the Court of Appeals decision are very clear on this. The Court of Appeals found that ATCC made its sales FOB Rockville, Maryland. The respondents in their briefs below have repeatedly asserted that the Court of Appeals correctly stated the facts in this case.
But they complained that the only proof was an affidavit by, I believe, one of your employees that said, that's the way we sell it, but there was nothing to support that.
There is additional proof in the record, Your Honor. There are two affidavits, the affidavit of Mr. Walden and the affidavit of Mr. Price. Both assert that the sales are FOB Rockville, and Mr. Walden was deposed at length by the plaintiffs below. Exhibit 6 to his deposition, which is in the record, is an excerpt of ATCC's catalog, which states on the cover in the lower left-hand corner that sales are FOB Rockville by a carrier of ATCC's choice.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May I ask the court, Mr. Lee will present argument to the respondents.
May it please the court. I'd like to first discuss jurisdiction. Secondly, I'd like to talk about Justice Tech's question in terms of, is there any amount of business that can be done by an out-of-state company that confers general jurisdiction without more? And then I'd finally like to address Justice Baker's question concerning what did the Court of Appeals do in this case that has ATCC so upset. With regard to jurisdiction, the two items that are being suggested to the court confers jurisdiction over this appeal is because there is a conflict with the Siskind case and because there is a dissent. With respect to the conflict, that's not a jurisdictional conflict. Siskind is a case that jurisdiction of the specially accepting defendant was held by the lower court and affirmed by the courts all the way through. It gets to the same result that the Court of Appeals did in this case. Siskind is a case that doesn't even talk about general jurisdiction. Siskind is an 82 case and it relies on New Anchor versus Burke. It's not on the same facts. It's not discussing the same law. It is simply not a jurisdictional conflict sufficient to confer jurisdiction on this court.
But isn't there complaint about the conflict based on the legal proposition of the burden of proof? Siskind says we recognize that it was incumbent upon these individuals to negate all basis of personal jurisdiction. The Court of Appeals in this case said the burden of proof to negate all possible grounds for personal jurisdiction. Would you agree or disagree that those are not the same statements?
I would agree that the same words are not being used. I do not think that the Court of Appeals in this case is suggesting a modification or a change of the traditional Texas.
Well, but his argument is what this statement really means is negate all basis of personal jurisdiction that the plaintiff alleges to exist that would lead a court to say to deny a special appearance. And all possible grounds for personal jurisdiction could lead you to a conclusion that whatever there may be out there, you're supposed to require them and negate them all, whether pled or not.
And certainly the respondents do not contend that that's the effect of the Court of Appeals decision.
I understand that, but they're just saying they've stated a improper burden of proof which conflicts with Siskind, and that's why we have jurisdiction.
But I think the only way that you get there, Judge, is if you read the Court of Appeals opinion to say something that is clearly, or at least it seems to us to be clear, that it is not saying. The Court of Appeals is not saying that the burden is on ATCC to deal with issues that are raised by no party at the special appearance hearing. What the Court of Appeals is saying, in my judgment, is that if an issue is raised at the evidentiary hearing on the special appearance, then the burden is upon the specially appearing party to negate it.
Well, are you suggesting then we should be able to glean from what they said and how they reached their conclusion whether they followed Siskind or what they said? In other words, if they only dealt with things that you pleaded, and if we find that they went further, as is suggested by the comparative jurisdiction dissent, or comparative, whatever you want to call it, that then would be a conflict?
I certainly think that if the court concludes that the majority of the Court of Civil Appeals predicates its opinion on some sort of comparative jurisdiction concept, that probably is a departure from Siskind, because the first person in this case to talk about comparative jurisdiction was Judge O'Connor. Comparative jurisdiction is certainly not a basis that was alleged or argued by either of the parties in the sense that ATCC is talking about it before this court and in the sense that Justice O'Connor is talking about it in her dissent. Now, it's our position that the Court of Appeals is doing no such thing. Thus, what we see here is straw issues being raised to create an arguable conflict with the standard that we don't believe the Court of Appeals was even confused about in the least. I don't know if that addresses your question. I'd be happy to take another shot at it.
As I recall, there's comments in the Court of Appeals that it would have been nice if they had produced evidence to show how this 3.5 sales percentage in Texas compared with other jurisdictions. And then we could see by that whether this was really a substantial contact with the state of Texas. But they didn't do that, so we'll move on and so forth. Those kind of comments.
Yes, and I do not view those as creating a new or independent burden upon the specially appearing party. What I think the Court of Appeals is doing, and if you go through the opinion and you look at every instance in which that court is talking about volume of sales to Texas versus whatever is happening in other jurisdictions, you will find it in one of two contexts. One context is comparing this case with other special appearance cases. And in that context, the court says a couple of times, it would be good if we knew more about what these numbers mean, because that might bring us within the Reyes case, or whatever case they happen to be discussing. And let me digress for a second. As long as we're talking about this concept of comparative jurisdiction, I think it would be helpful if the court is clear on what at least we think the Court of Appeals is trying to say on the subject. What the evidence before the trial court was is this is a company that manufactures biological agents, does it entirely by mail order, and ships them to 50 states. Of those 50 states,
let me ask you this. Why does it matter what state they ship to if title passes in Maryland?
The Court of Appeals, and I think properly, says that where title passes is not irrelevant, but it's not dispositive. For jurisdictional purposes, to make title passage the dispositive fact, which is what ATCC would like to see the result in this case, is going to allow mail order operations to immunize themselves from the exercise of general jurisdiction by the simple expedient of saying, we're sending this stuff out FOB. I think that the correct analysis is the one that the court uses, and that is, we'll look at what the title status of the product is, we'll look at what the title status of supplies that the specially appearing defendant buys in the forum state, what that status is, and we're going to weigh that in the mix, but we are not going to make, whether or not the product is FOB or not, a dispositive kind of point. And that just seems intuitively so natural to me that maybe
are you saying that if ATCC sells FOB in Maryland but buys FOB in Texas, that cancels out as a dispositive issue?
I don't think that's what the court is saying at all. I think what the court is saying is we'll look at what they're doing up in Maryland because it probably is significant with respect to what kinds of efforts are they taking to avoid the jurisdiction of other
courts.
Well,
but I mean, if that's where title passes, that doesn't seem, I mean, I understand your point of where that could lead you in mail order catalogs and things like that. But let's say this was a store. I mean, you come to the store, you pick up the goods there, which is sort of what FOB Maryland implies, that's where you're going to pick up the goods. Why would that be any different?
In that set of circumstances, I think that it is different. The situation is different because the marketing efforts of the store, the sticks and bricks kind of store, is designed to attract customers to it for purchases. Whereas what this defendant is doing is intentionally availing itself of customers in 50 states and is marketing in an outward fashion. And they're doing about $500,000, if my recollection serves correctly, worth of business in Texas in the sense that they are selling to Texas residents. That's where their market is.
If comparative jurisdiction doesn't matter, has it subjected itself to personal jurisdiction in all 50 states?
No, I don't think so.
Why not?
The way that the evidence seems to shake out in this case is that this company does business in all 50 states. We do know that. Of the six largest states that it does business in, they're in California for about 16% of their market. They're in Maryland, which is where they're domiciled, for about 10% of their market. And they've got four other states, including Texas, all of whom are lurking around in the mid-single digits. And then the market share drops off very dramatically. I think that it's a much different case if we're in Wisconsin or Vermont, where the profit share from that forum is 0.1%.
But why, unless you're comparing it?
Because what you're looking at is not as much the number of contacts, but the quality and the significance of the contacts.
You say that, but then when I ask you, you say, well, if there were this many dollars or this much market share, it would matter. And that's what the Court of Appeals seemed to say. We wish we knew this because it would help us decide this case. And if that's true, then there is comparative jurisdiction.
I think that if there is, I think market share kinds of evidence can matter the special appearance here. I think that how much of a profit stream comes out of a jurisdiction can matter. And I guess I was unclear because I do think that if the defendant or the plaintiff, as far as that goes, would choose to present it, that evidence of what's going on in other jurisdictions can matter. Where I disagree with ATCC is the suggestion that this opinion somehow places a burden upon a specially appearing party to present that kind of evidence.
Is there anything about this product that is addressed particularly to Texas or any other jurisdiction?
This is apparently the only source in the United States of the kind of products and services that they provide, at least some of their products and services. So of necessity, if you're looking for germs, you apparently have to go to ATCC.
And
there's nothing, and you know, that really is basically what the underlying lawsuit is all about, and hopefully someday somebody will get to discuss those issues. If you're asking, is there anything that ATCC does that is specifically directed at Texas, do we have a special product for the Texas market?
like the oil field or something.
Yeah, or, you know, a brucellosis product or something to that effect. The record does not reflect that to be the case, and any reasonable inference drawn from the record would suggest that there isn't anything like that going on, except to the extent that Texas is a fairly big market, so perhaps one would infer they might be doing something special for the Med Center. But nothing directly and very little inferentially suggesting that they are specifically targeting Texas.
Mr. Lee, you said that there are two arguments on jurisdiction that you wanted to make, one about the Siskind opinion and the other about the dissenting opinion from Justice O'Connor. Would you address that?
I would, and I'm really not going to be able to shed very much light on this subject. I was looking last night to see if I could uncover a similar situation where a party was suggesting that dissent jurisdiction was conferred by a dissenting judge on a motion for en banc rehearing. And I will confess that I was unable to do that. I don't think that there is any precedent out there at this time addressing this situation. If there is, I have simply missed it.
But why shouldn't that be the basis of jurisdiction if you've got a sitting justice who files a substantive dissent? I mean, I might agree if it were just dissent noted, but she actually writes an opinion on the merits. So why should that not be considered for purposes of dissent jurisdiction?
Because I think that it is important to contain the dissent jurisdiction to the tribunal that is making the decision that is getting reviewed. It would be one thing if the motion en banc had been granted and you had picked up a dissent at that point in time.
But our O'Connor case says that the particular judge that's at issue here is part of the court that made the decision and that she has a right to such a dissent as being part of the court, even if she doesn't sit on the panel.
Yes. And I don't think that it is inconsistent to say that there is that right, but that dissent from a completely different procedural question is not a jurisdiction-producing dissent.
Well, but the statute is the justices of a court of appeals disagree on a question of law material to the decision. So we have to apply those words here.
I think that's right. And it is not material to the decision whether or not to grant the motion for rehearing en banc as to, I'm not saying that right, what I was going to say, as to whether one of the justices on the panel happens to disagree with the original, of the whole court, happens to disagree with the original
but
panel.
But all that modifies question of law. I mean, she disagrees.
I agree.
On a question of law.
I agree. And it would seem to me that the purpose of the statute is to focus on that part of the court that's making the decision that's going to be reviewed. The practical effect, and perhaps this is not a concern for the court, but the practical effect of saying that a dissent to a motion for rehearing en banc confers jurisdiction to this court is that everybody will always file the en banc rehearing in hopes of picking up a dissent and thus getting a jurisdictional free ride.
Well, isn't that the whole purpose of asking for an en banc? You hope if you get nine people looking at it instead of three, that you might get a change.
The whole purpose
and
of
so if you're a judge that's committed to a viewpoint on a question of law, that case says you have the right to dissent and state the reason why you disagree.
Yes.
So that there seems to me to be a disagreement on this court as to an issue of material law to the disposition of this case.
And I do not disagree with that. What I would submit is that the purpose of the jurisdictional statute is to be looking at the decision of the court or part of the court that is making the decision this court's going to review. So that it seems to me like there is a difference between drawing a dissent on an en banc rehearing. And you're certainly right. The reason the lawyers file for en banc rehearings in the unusual circumstances that they do in the Texas appellate courts is to try to get the panel decision turned around. But it doesn't seem to me like you should encourage them to be filing those motions for the purpose of gathering a dissent on the denial of the motion.
Well, I don't have any statistics, but I suspect that in courts of appeals, the success of the en banc request practice is practically nil.
I've never known it to work myself.
If the dissent here from the denial of the rehearing in bank is considered a dissent on a question material to the decision of the court, is it possible for a 7-judge court that's 3 on the panel in a trying to think, would it be possible for a couple of judges to write a dissenting opinion that basically that would be material to the decision that could overrule a 3-judge panel? And if they don't take it in bank, could you end up with enough judges that overrule it? I guess it wouldn't be 7. Maybe you'd have 9 judges on a court of appeals. 9 judges on a court of appeals. They don't have enough to take it in bank, but they've got enough judges who would write a dissent to the failure to go in bank that could reverse the decision of a 3-judge panel. If you considered judges who are not on the panel, their decisions to be material decision in the case, would that be possible?
I think the numbers work out, and where my knowledge breaks down is I don't know how many votes you have to have for an en banc rehearing. If it's a simple majority, you can make the numbers work out on a 9-member court there, because you can have a dissent written by 4 that doesn't get you to an en banc, to the en banc threshold if it's 50% or more. And thus you have a dissent, you know, you have 4 dissenting judges against a panel of 2, presumably.
Right.
No, 3.
And 2 out of the other 9 don't vote for the en banc.
Well, what I'm curious about is this becomes the opinion of the first court of appeals, and it binds the court in future cases, does it not?
Right.
Well, then why would not the dissent on a question material in the case not give us dissent jurisdiction if it is the opinion of the court?
Because the question that is that the dissent is the procedural context, the decision the court is making that attracts the dissent is to not hear.
But again, I understand the distinction. I don't understand the difference. I mean, you've got a substantive dissent on a point of law, and this 3-judge panel opinion binds the court and is the court's decision. So I understand the procedural difference, but substantively, I don't understand why it should be treated any differently. I mean, if Judge O'Connor is going to be bound by this decision in the panel she sits on, I don't understand why her dissent on this point of law would be.
Because if she's not, I'm sorry, I did not mean to interrupt. If she is not sitting on the panel that's deciding the case, she should not be the one who is triggering this court's jurisdiction to review that panel decision. That would be my response.
And my response is, I don't understand why, if she is bound by that panel's decision in later cases.
Because she did not sit on the panel to begin with.
But she can't dissent in future cases if she's truly bound. The next time the issue comes up, she can't dissent. She has to follow the custom.
She has to follow the law. It is empirically not true that she can't dissent, as Court of Appeals judges do dissent.
Not on that point.
If she follows
the prior law, she can't file a dissent based on that question of law because it's been decided in her Court of Appeals district.
It's been decided, but I think that it is, I think one sees dissenting opinions of the, gee, this is the law, but I sure wish that it were somehow, that it was something different, and thus I dissent.
Any other questions? Thank you, Jones.
Just a few brief points. I'm afraid I wasn't very helpful on the initial jurisdictional question posed by Justice Phillips. I had my mind full of other jurisdictional matters. I would note that respondents below did not challenge our assertion of jurisdiction based on the code provision referred to by Justice Phillips.
Can you waive a jurisdictional argument?
Yes.
That can be waived? We can have jurisdiction simply because they didn't make this argument?
No, my point was simply that I wish we could have been more helpful to the court, and if they had brought the issue before the court and briefed it, we obviously would have replied, and we would do so now if the court would like us to take a look at that issue and request further briefing. But I don't think it's necessary based on the literal language of the statute and also the other grounds of jurisdiction that we have alleged. Let me just make two brief points about respondents' substantive argument to the extent that I got them straight. First of all, on the question of whether the Court of Appeals did, in fact, impose a different standard, a different burden standard below, I think the answer is clear. If you read their decision carefully, they say the specially appearing defendant has the burden of proving all possible, that's the key word that's in there, all possible bases of jurisdiction. And it goes on to refer to possible bases of jurisdiction that have not been alleged by the plaintiff below. That is a departure from the law of this court. The word possible appears only in one case, also a First Court of Appeals decision, the Garner case. And if you go back and look at Garner, they cite to this court's decision in Kawasaki when they use the word possible, but there's nothing in the Kawasaki decision. That standard, all possible, negating all possible jurisdictional facts, is a new standard, and I submit that given the number of special appearances that you have in the Texas courts, it's important to straighten out this issue so that other courts of appeals and trial courts are not misled by the decision below.
Could a mail order company escape liability or jurisdiction in any of the 50 states simply by making delivery FOB its home state?
I think that's similar to the question I tried to respond to earlier from Justice Hecht, and I believe the answer is without more, yes. If that's the only evidence in the record that you've made sales to the forum in question, that the sales have been structured FOB, then there would be no basis for jurisdiction because there would be no indication of purposeful availment. I'm certainly not.
But is that a statement then, in your view, that if that's the only evidence, then there's no personal jurisdiction?
Yes, Justice Baker, that's our position.
But that's not the only evidence, at least from the viewpoint of the
it's not the only field. It's not the only evidence in this case, but clearly the bedrock fact that plaintiffs relied on and the Court of Appeals relied on was the volume and repetitive nature of ATCC's sales to Texas. Everything else in the record was...
A question then, the rule which you cited to us earlier is on general jurisdiction whether the defendant purposely established minimum contacts with the forum state. Minimum suggests in some respects, at least as far as the evidence, that it doesn't have to be much, but then the second part of the inquiry is does it comport with due process, et cetera, which I read the Court of Appeals saying, well, we're looking at these things that happen. This standing alone may not be enough. That standing alone may not be enough, but we put it all together, and it is purposely established minimum contacts with the foreign state in their view. Even though they talked about, well, you could have given us some comparative evidence, but what they did state, if you put it all together, in their view, was minimum, purposeful minimum contact.
The Court of Appeals did seem to put it all together, or as to use the language of the denial of rehearing, add additional pebbles to the scale, but you can put a lot of things together, and if there's not the glue to hold them together, they don't belong together. And clearly in personal jurisdiction cases, The glue is the defendant's intent, the intent to reach out and purposefully avail itself of the privilege of business in the forum.
Could you make a broad statement here when you look at all of these facts that they talked about and put them together, that it appears to a rational person that your company intentionally wanted to make sales and make profits out of Texas residents as their customers, and they sent international or national catalogs in advertising what they do, that they came to trade shows, set up booths, and told people what they did, and they bought supplies from Texas people and took title in Texas, that that's enough to establish purposeful minimum contact?
I don't think, I'm not going to say no one would ever make that inference, but I don't think that's the plausible inference on the facts of this case. The plausible inference on the facts of this case is that ATTC held itself out to serve the worldwide medical and biological research community from its offices in Rockville. And if people wanted to deal with ATCC, in effect, they had to come to Rockville to do it.
Well, why did you think they chose to go to Texas at least four or five times and have booths to talk to Texas people in Texas?
The evidence of record is clear that those trips were meetings of national scientific organizations that happened to be in Texas. That's precisely the fortuitous kind of contact with a foreign state that is not sufficient to provide.
But what if you add the fact that they set up a booth and told people, here's what we sell and here's how you can buy it. You just have to send your order to our office in Maryland and we'll be happy to sell to you.
I would say that the more logical inference in that circumstance is that ATCC representatives went to Texas to attend a scientific meeting and everybody was setting up booths. That's what happens at these scientific meetings. It's not as if they singled out Texas as a market.
Any other questions? Thank you, Council.